Betcher, and this is the second of our two sessions considering the novel by C.S. Lewis, Till We Have Faces. I'll just recap a little bit some of the things we talked about on Tuesday. When I heard that the theme for this session of the winter program was worship, the life and journey of the people of God, this novel immediately sprang to mind. And I don't know why, because it isn't all that much about worship. But it does say a lot to me about faith and unbelief and my search for God and my journey towards Him. We also talked a bit about the mythic elements of myth that seem to transcend time and geography, and how skillfully Lewis has used some of these elements in weaving his retelling of the myth. I suggested some themes: humanity's perceptions of the gods, worship, especially ungod worship, and the archetype of the scapegoat, kinds of love, Aurel's journey, the final journey towards self-knowledge, and then the answers of the god. And there are some peripheral themes, ugliness and beauty, blindness and sight, slavery and freedom. And I mentioned too that the first-person narrator is unreliable, because you only see and hear things through that person's eyes. You don't know what the objective facts are. And that any time you have anything written in the first person, you have to ask, is this viewpoint biased? Of course the answer is yes. And then the determination has to be made, how biased is it and in what direction? And that may not be obvious on a first or even the second reading of this, but I think the bias of the first person narrator, Queen Aurel of Gloam, comes through very clearly in her second book. She wrote her first book as a complaint against the gods, and was determined to have an answer from the gods to her questions. Today, let's look at Aurel's progress towards self-knowledge, and then the final judgment of the god, the final answer that she received. There are a couple of really heavy things that Aurel went through in her journey towards self-knowledge, and we touched briefly on them on Tuesday. The first one, I think, is her relationship with her second sister, who is portrayed through the first part of the novel as a vain, selfish, sniveling, whining, albeit beautiful, girl. Not an attractive character. The tone is set very early in the novel when Aurel writes about the day that her mother died and she and Redivald had their hair cut off. As the shears snipped and Redivald's curls fell off, the slaves said, "Oh, what a pity, all the gold gone." They said nothing like that while I was being shorn. And immediately the contrast between the two sisters is set up. Page 21, after the fox comes to start tutoring the girl in anticipation of the day when the king will have a son. Things went all right to start with, but then after Psyche was born, Aurel tells us, "And now it was always we three, the fox, Psyche, and I, alone together. Redivald had always hated our lessons, and, but for the fear of the king, would never have come at all. Now it seemed the king had put all three of his daughters out of his mind, and Redivald had her own way." The impression one gets of her is that she's not particularly interested in very much other than herself. And then when she begins to grow up and starts flirting with the soldier, our old dislike for her sister becomes even more active because the king blames her for not looking after her sister. And then the terrible day when the priest of Angit determines that Psyche is the accursed, the perfect, beautiful accursed who must be sacrificed to turn the tide of the drought in the land. Immediately the fox and Orowal know how he found out that the people were worshipping Psyche, because Redival had become very pious and had been paying many visits to the house of Angit. As Psyche is being prepared for the sacrifice, Redival comes to Psyche and sobs, "Isn't it a terrible thing? They're not going to do it to all of us, are they? I didn't mean any harm." I put my face up close to hers and said very low but distinctly, "Redival, if there is one single hour when I am Queen of Gloam or even mistress of this house, I'll hang you by the thumbs at a slow fire until you die." "Oh, cruel, cruel," sobbed Redival. "How can you say such things when I'm so miserable already? Sister, don't be angry. Comfort me." I pushed her away from me and passed on. I had known Redival's tears ever since I could remember. They were not wholly feigned, nor much dearer than ditch water. It's likely enough she meant less mischief than she had done. She never knew how much she meant, and was now in her fashion sorry. But a new brooch, much more a new lover, would have had her drying her eyes and laughing in no time. But then the shock that comes to Orowal, having built up this portrait of a shallow, silly, pretty girl. In fact, I wrote a little note here, after Redival has been married to Trunia, the king of Fars, and Orowal and her council decide that the second son was to be her heir. They say, "This Darren was, for the son of so silly a mother, a right-minded boy." And I wrote the little note here, "Was Redival really silly, or was she also silly because she was expected to be?" I'm not sure. But then the hard things that Orowal has to face when Taryn, the young man who had been made a eunuch and sent off for flirting with the Princess Redival, comes back and tells Orowal some home truths about herself. "Your sister queen," said the eunuch. "Ah, she was a pretty little girl. Is she still alive?" "She is the queen of Fars," I said. "Ah, so, Fars. I remember. One forgets names of all these little countries. Yes, a pretty little girl. I took pity on her. She was lonely." "Lonely?" said I. "Oh, yes, very lonely. After the other princess, the baby came. She used to say, 'First of all, Orowal loved me much. Then the fox came and she loved me little. And then the baby came and she loved me not at all.'" One thing was certain, I had never thought at all how it might be for her when I turned first to the fox and then for Psyche. For it had somehow been settled in my mind from the very beginning that I was the pitiable and ill-used one. She had her gold curls, didn't she? The jolt that Orowal had to go through to realize that perhaps Redival had her side to the story, too. One step towards self-knowledge. Another relationship which is very hard for Orowal, and coming to really understand it is painful for her, and that's her relationship with Bardia. We looked at some of the passages on Tuesday where she makes little comments like, "If you're ugly enough, men soon give up thinking of you as a woman at all," or, "Bardia treated me more and more like a man, never doubting that I liked it." And we don't really know, she doesn't tell us until he is ill and dying, what her feelings for him were, and that wonderful, terrible scene after he has died when Orwell goes to visit the widow. Or at first, when she wants to go to him in his illness, and Arnim the priest, Bardia is your most loyal and loving subject. To see you would call up all his powers, perhaps crack them. He'd rouse himself to his duty and courtesy. 100 affairs of state on which he meant to speak to you would crowd into his mind. It might kill him. Leave him to drowse and dream. It's his best chance now. It was as bitter a truth as I had ever tasted, but I drank it. On the fifth day, Arnim came to me, himself weeping, and I knew his tidings without words. And this is a strange folly, that what seemed to me worst of all was that Bardia had died without ever hearing what it would have shamed him to hear. It seemed to me that all would have been bearable if once only I could have gone to him and whispered in his ear, Bardia, I loved you. When they laid him on the pyre, I could only stand by to honor him, because I was neither his wife nor kin. I might not wail nor beat the breast for him. Ah, if I could have beaten the breast, I would have put on steel gloves or hedgehog skins to do it. And then when she goes to visit the widow, and the widow quite dispassionately tells her, you destroyed Bardia. You used him and used him and used him. You kept him at work until his strength was drained and he had nothing left to give, anything else. And Arwell is angry. Her first thought is to subject Anset, the widow, to torture and to kill her. And she says, and now those divine surgeons had me tied down and were at work. My anger protected me only for a short time. Anger wearies itself out and truth comes in, for it was all true, truer than Anset could know. I had rejoiced when there was oppressive work, had heaped up needless work to keep him late at the palace, plied him with questions for the mere pleasure of hearing his voice, anything to put off the moment when he would go and leave me to my emptiness, and I hated him for going. Did I hate him then? Indeed, I believe so. A love like that can grow to be 9/10 hatred and still call itself love. And these two confrontations with her own self lead Arwell on her final downward journey. I think this is one of the things that has really pressed on me in these last days. I didn't realize until this last rereading how I identified with Arwell in this way. It's really a painful thing to acknowledge that you will never have a child of your own. And it's a very bitter thing never to have had a man say, I love you, except as a father or an uncle or a brother or a cousin would. And that pain and the bitterness so easily, whether rightly or not, become linked with the conviction that they are caused by ugliness of soul. And that leads to despair. And the despair leads to the banks of the Shenet or Railroad Creek. And it's only the voice of the God that sends you climbing back in through the gloom into the dailiness of life. And the God doesn't promise that everything will be all right or that you'll get anything that you desire. The God just says, don't do it. And to go back and continue on with the struggle, hoping that there will be some further word from the gods. And that was as low as I went. Orwell still had something lower. She thinks, however I might have devoured Bardia, I had at least loved Psyche truly. There, if nowhere else, I had the right of it, and the gods were in the wrong. But when you think something like that, you know that you're going to be plastered with something else. Mm-hmm. And Orwell is. After her vision, in which she struggles across the burning desert, and then is taken down into the cavern with her book to read her complaint, she has to face the truth. I think I'm just going to read the whole of the book that she reads, which is not the book that she thought she had written. I know what you'll say. You'll say the real gods are not at all like Ungud, and I was shown a real god and the house of a real god and ought to know it. Hypocrites. I do know it, as if that would heal my wound. I could have endured it if you were things like Ungud and a shadow brute. You know well that I never really began to hate you until Psyche began talking of her palace and her lover and her husband. Why did you lie to me? You said a brute would devour her. Well, why didn't it? I'd have wept for her and buried what was left and built her a tomb and... But to steal her love from me, can it be that you really don't understand? Do you think we mortals will find you gods easier to bear because you're beautiful? I tell you, if that's true, we'll find it 1,000 times worse. For then, I know what beauty does. You'll lure and entice. You'll leave us nothing, nothing that's worth our keeping or your taking. Those we love best, whoever's most worth loving, those are the very ones you'll pick. Oh, I can see it happening age after age and growing worse and worse the more you reveal your beauty. The son turning his back on the mother and the bride on her groom, stolen away by this everlasting calling of the gods. Taken where we can't follow. It would be far better for us if you were foul and ravening. We'd rather you drank their blood than stole their hearts. We'd rather they were ours and dead than yours and made immortal. But to steal her love from me, to make her see things I couldn't see. Oh, you'll say, who have been whispering it to me these 40 years, that I'd signed enough that her palace was real. I could have known the truth if I'd wanted. But how could I want to know it? Tell me that. The girl was mine. What right had you to steal her away into your dreadful heights? You'll say I was jealous. Jealous of Psyche? Not while she was mine. If you'd gone the other way to work, if it was my eyes you had opened, you'd soon have seen how I would have shown her and told her and taught her and led her up to my level. But to hear a chit of a girl who had, or ought to have had, no thought in her head that I'd not put there, setting up for a seer and a prophetess and next thing to a goddess, how could anyone endure it? That's why I say it makes no difference whether you're fair or foul. That there should be gods at all, there's our misery and bitter wrong. There's no room for you and us in the same world. You're a tree in whose shadow we can't thrive. We want to be our own. I was my own, and Psyche was mine, and no one else had any right to her. Oh, you'll say you took her away into bliss and joy such as I could never have given her, and I ought to have been glad of it for her sake. Why? What should I care for some terrible new happiness which I hadn't given her? And which separated her from me. Do you think I wanted her to be happy that way? It would have been better if I'd seen the brute tear her to pieces before my eyes. You stole her to make her happy, did you? Why, every wheedling, smiling, catfoot rogue who lures away another man's wife or slave or dog might say the same. Dog, no. That's very much to the purpose. I'll thank you to let me feed my own. It needs no titbits from your table. Did you ever remember whose the girl was? She was mine. Mine! Do you not know what the word means? Mine! You're thieves, seducers. That's my wrong. I'll not complain, and not now, that you're blood drinkers and man-eaters. I'm past that. Enough! Said the judge. There was utter silence around me. And she realized that she had been reading the book over and over and over again. And the voice I read it in was strange to my ears. There was given to me a certainty that this, at last, was my real voice. And then her devastating realization, the judge asks, "Are you answered?" "Yes," said I. And then on page 294, the complaint was the answer. To have heard myself making it was to be answered. Likely men talk of saying what they mean. Often when he was teaching me to write in Greek, the fox would say, "Child, to say the very thing you really mean, the whole of it, nothing more or less or other than what you really mean, that's the whole art and joy of words." A glib saying. When the time comes to you at which you will be forced at last to utter the speech which has lain at the center of your soul for years, which you have all that time but idiot-like been saying over and over, you'll not talk about the joy of words. I saw well why the gods do not speak to us openly nor let us answer. Till that word can be dug out of us, why should they hear the babble that we think we mean? How can they meet us face to face till we have faces? She says in this book that she knows the gods will say that she should have believed in them, she should have known that they were real. And we know that too, we know she should have. There are many occasions throughout the novel when she has been given glimpses and has turned away from them. The first that she refuses to accept is on her first journey to Psyche's Valley, when she has gone expecting to bury the bones and instead has found beautiful, happy, healthy Psyche, and telling her story how the west wind had picked her up and brought her to the valley. It was the god of the wind, West Wind himself. And Aurel asks, "Were you awake, Psyche?" "Oh, it was no dream. One can't dream things like that because one's never seen things like that. He was in human shape, but you couldn't mistake him for a man. Oh, sister, you'd understand if you'd seen. How can I make you understand? You've seen lepers?" "Well, of course." "And you know how healthy people look beside a leper?" "You mean healthier and readier than ever?" "Yes. Now we, beside the gods, are like lepers beside us." "Do you mean this god was so red?" She laughed and clapped her hands. "Oh, it's no use. I see I've not given you the idea at all." And she tells a little bit more, and then she says, "I felt ashamed." "But what of, Psyche? They hadn't stripped you naked or anything?" "No, no, Maya, ashamed of looking like a mortal, ashamed of being a mortal." "But how could you help that?" And Psyche says, "Don't you think the things people are most ashamed of are the things they can't help?" And she still tries to tell about the god, how wonderful he was, and then she says, "The West Wind is a merry, rough god. Sister, do you think young gods have to be taught how to handle us? A hasty touch from hands like theirs, and we'd fall to pieces." And I couldn't help thinking of those wonderful lines in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, when the beavers are telling the children about Aslan, the golden lion who is the Christ figure, and how wonderful he is. And yet how terrible, too. Mrs. Beaver says, "If there's anyone who can appear before Aslan without their knees knocking, they're either braver than most or else just silly." "Then he isn't safe?" asked Lucy. "Safe?" said Mr. Beaver. "Don't you hear what Mrs. Beaver tells you? Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe. But he's good." And the picture we get of the West Wind and even of Psyche's god himself is that they aren't safe, but they are good. And Orwell has the glimpse of the god's house that he has built for Psyche in the early morning mist. And it's almost as though she deliberately and consciously rejects the possibility that it could have been real. Now you who read, give judgment. That moment when I either saw or thought I saw the house, does it tell against the gods or against me? Would they, if they answered, make it a part of their defense, say it was a sign, a hint, beckoning me to answer the riddle one way or the other? I'll not grant them that. What is the use of a sign which is itself only another riddle? And so she rejects the vision of the god. And then when she has tried to persuade Psyche to come home with her and has succeeded in persuading Psyche to take the lamp and the knife to kill the monstrosity that Orwell is convinced the god must be, then when Psyche's lamp awakens the god, Orwell hears it also. The great voice which rose up from somewhere close to the light went through my whole body in such a swift wave of terror that it blotted out even the pain in my arm. It was no ugly sound. Even in its implacable sternness, it was golden. My terror was the salute that mortal flesh gives to immortal things. And then the god appears to her. There came as if it were a lightning that endured. That is, the look of it was the look of lightning, pale, dazzling, without warmth or comfort, showing each smallest thing with fierce distinctness, but it did not go away. This great light stood over me as still as a candle burning in a curtained and shuttered room. In the center of that light was something like a man. It's strange that I cannot tell you its size. Its face was far above me, yet memory does not show the shape as a giant's. And I do not know whether it stood or seemed to stand on the far side of the water or on the water itself. Not my eyes only, but my heart and blood and very brain were too weak for it. A monster, the shadow brute that I and all Gloam had imagined, would have subdued me less than the beauty this face wore. And I think that anger, what men call anger, would have been more supportable than the passionless and measureless rejection with which it looked upon me. He rejected, denied, answered, and worst of all, he knew all that I had thought or done or been. A Greek verse says that even the gods cannot change the past. But is this true? He made it to be as if from the beginning I had known that Psyche's lover was a god, and as if all my doubtings, fears, guessings, debatings, questionings of Bardia, questionings of the fox, all the rummage and business of it, had been trumped up foolery, dust blown in my own eyes by myself. You who read my book, judge. Was it so? Or at least, had it been so in the very past before the god changed the past? And if they can indeed change the past, why do they never do so in mercy? She has been confronted with the god, but still, her pride and insistence on being right has rejected the words that the god has given her. And we mentioned on Tuesday that the only result, or the most obvious result in herself of this hearing the god speak, was that she was no longer afraid of her father. And that started her on the road to being a queen. The end of her first book. Still the charges against the gods. Now you who read, judge between the gods and me. They gave me nothing in the world to love but Psyche, and then took her from me. But that was not enough. They then brought me to her at such a place and time that it hung on my word whether she should continue in bliss or be cast out into misery. They would not tell me whether she was the bride of a god, or mad, or a brute's or a villain's spoil. They would give no clear sign, though I begged for it. I had to guess. And because I guessed wrong, they punished me. What's worse, punished me through her. And even that was not enough. They have now sent out a lying story in which I was given no riddle to guess, but knew and saw that she was the god's bride, and of my own will destroyed her, and that for jealousy, as if I were another Redival. I say the gods deal very unrightly with us. Why must holy places be dark places? I say, therefore, that there is no creature, toad, scorpion, or serpent, so noxious to man as the gods. Let them answer my charge if they can. It may well be that instead of answering, they'll strike me mad or leprous or turn me into beast or bird or tree. But will not all the world then know, and the gods will know it, knows, that this is because they have no answer? Oh, the depths of despair and ugliness. Well, thank goodness she continues on then with the second book, in which she has further encounters with divine beings. One of the interesting passages in the book is in her vision, when she sees Psyche trying to gather the wool from the golden rams. In her vision, she finds herself crossing a river and then sees the sheep, golden as high as horses, so bright that she couldn't look at them. And she says, the air of that country was sweet as music. Now those, thought I, are the rams of the gods. If I can steal but one golden flock off their sides, I shall have beauty. Redival's ringlets were nothing to that wool. And in my vision, I was able to do what I had feared to do at the Shenet, where I went into the cold water up to my knee, up to my belly, up to my neck, and then lost bottom and swam and found the bottom again, and came up out of the river into the pastures of the gods. And I walked forward over that holy turf with a good and glad heart. But all the rams came at me. They drew closer to one another as their onrush brought them closer to me, till it was a solid wall of living gold. And with terrible force their curled horns struck me and knocked me flat, and their hoofs trampled me. They were not doing it in anger. They rushed over me in their joy. Perhaps they did not see me. Certainly I was nothing in their minds. I understood it well. They butted and trampled me because their gladness led them on. The divine nature wounds and perhaps destroys us merely by being what it is. And then in the vision she sees Psyche walking along and picking the golden fleece off the bushes. She doesn't have to endanger herself by confronting the rams directly. In the last visions, when after the judgment where she has read her book, and Aurel sees the fox again, as he had been when he was younger, still her teacher, and he shows her the last pictures, the last visions, so that she observes the trials and the tests that Psyche had to go through. And Orwell, in the vision, is confronted with what she has done to Psyche in trying to prevent her from following the god, trying to prevent her from doing what she has to do. The fox and I were alone again. Did we really do these things to her, I asked. Yes, all here is true. And we said we loved her. And the fox says, and we did. She had no more dangerous enemies than us. And in that far distant day when the gods become wholly beautiful, or we at last are shown how beautiful they always were, this will happen more and more. For mortals, as you said, will become more and more jealous. And mother and wife and child and friend will all be in league to keep a soul from being united with the divine nature. And the one thing that seems to give Aurel the least speck of comfort at this point is the thought that Psyche did not have to suffer, that somehow by the intervention of the god, Aurel has borne all the anguish and pain and heartache of the tests that Psyche has had to go through. So Psyche approached them as though they were a puzzle or a difficult task, but not as though they were a torture. And Aurel is at last cleansed and can ask Psyche for forgiveness. O Psyche, O goddess, I say, never again will I call you mine, but all there is of me shall be yours. Alas, you now know what it's worth. I never wished you well, never had one selfless thought of you. I was a craver. She bent over me to lift me up. She says, but Maya, I have not given you the casket. You know I went on that long journey to fetch the beauty that will make Angad beautiful. I stood up then. Her hands burned me, a painless burning when they met mine. And they are restored and made whole for one another again. Psyche says, did I not tell you, Maya, that a day was coming when you and I would meet in my house and no cloud between us? Joy silenced me, and I thought that I had now come to the highest and to the utmost fullness of being which the human soul can contain. But now what was this? You have seen the torches grow pale when men open the shutters and broad summer morning shines in on the feasting hall? So now, from a strange look in Psyche's face, I could see she knew something she had not spoken of, or from a glorious and awful deepening in the blue sky above us, or from a deep breath like a sigh, I knew that all this had only been preparation. Some far greater matter was upon us. The voices spoke again. They were awed and trembled. The god is coming into his house. The god comes to judge Arwal. If Psyche had not held me by the hand, I should have sunk down. I was being unmade. I was no one. But that's little to say. Rather, Psyche herself was in a manner no one. I loved her as I would once have thought it impossible to love, would have died any death for her. And yet it was not now, she that really counted. Or if she counted, and oh, gloriously she did, it was for another's sake. The earth and stars and sun, all that was or will be, existed for his sake, and he was coming. The most dreadful, the most beautiful, the only dread and beauty there is, was coming. And Orwell looks and sees two reflections in the pool at her and Psyche's feet. Two Psyches, both beautiful, if that mattered now, yet not exactly the same. You also are Psyche, came the great voice. I looked up then, but I saw no god, no pillared court. I was in the palace gardens, my foolish book in my hand. The vision to the eye had, I think, faded one moment before the oracle to the ear. But then the last wonderful, wonderful statement from Arwal. I ended my first book with the words, no answer. I know now, Lord, why you utter no answer. You are yourself the answer. Before your face, questions die away. What do you want to say?
I want to make sure I understand all those events in the second book, you know, and I think I have ideas, but I'm not certain.
Well, I'm not sure that my answer is the right one.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. I should say that. But I remember one thing about how she said something about how Oriol bore the anguish, mm-hmm. you know, that mm-hmm. Psyche had done all those... mm-hmm.
Yeah, the fox tells her.
Page 300.
Yeah.
And that was just after. I think the four things had just been run through, where Psyche jumps, you know, stands at the river, and then mm-hmm. she picks the fleece of the golden rams.
Mm-hmm. And sorts the seeds.
Sorts the seeds.
Mm-hmm. And then goes down into the underworld.
Yeah, those four things. And I'm trying to. Oriol had gone through those similar experiences, or at different points in the book, or at least in her mind, she had sort of.
In different ways, You remember at one point where she said that she had a dream at night about sorting the seeds. Mm-hmm. And it was an impossible task. But earlier in that day, she had been trying to sort out facts, trying to sort out truths. And then one of her duties as queen was to sit in judgment. And people had complaints against each other. She had to sit and judge. And she makes the statement, oh, I think it was after she had come to realize what she had done to Redival by her indifference and coldness. And she became convinced that she had an ugly soul and she was going to strive to make her soul more beautiful and therefore more acceptable, and perhaps the gods would give her a little peace. And she says, then, they say that the dooms, the judgments I handed down at that time were the best ever rendered in Gloam. As though she had been given a strength greater than she really had. She went through anguish in her daily life, so that even though she didn't go through the tests in the same way that Psyche did, she went through all of the anguish of it, so that Psyche then could perform the actual tests without being scathed. And that I think is the punishment that the god gave her at the very beginning when he first appeared and he said to her, you also are Psyche. And she didn't understand what that meant. She lived in daily expectation that some horrible death was going to come upon her when she had to fight Argan to prevent war, when they had the single combat. She expected then that Argan was the instrument of the gods and that he would kill her. But that didn't happen. She was forced to keep on living in anguish and pain and suffering. Mental anguish and mental pain. And work through that.
I don't remember that part where the god said, you also are Psyche. Was that earlier in the book?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. 170, I think.
Right after she
when she had taken Psyche the lamp and said, you know, you have to light this lamp and see what awful monstrosity it is that's been coming to you in the darkness, and then kill it. And the lamp awakens the god, and then the god's voice appears, and he shows himself to her. And the section I read where she at this point the god confronts her with the truth, but she rejects it. She says, the god is making it seem as though I knew that he was real. And she rejects that, but the god says to her, now Psyche goes out in exile. Now she must hunger and thirst and tread hard roads. Those against whom I cannot fight must do their will upon her. You, woman, shall know yourself and your work. You also shall be Psyche. And then at the very end, when the god's voice says, you also are Psyche, that's the complete transformation that she has gone through. She is. She's gone down into the very depths and then come up again and has been transformed and is beautiful and can stand side by side with Psyche in that identification.
Like in the Greek myth, it talks about gods, it's plural, and also in that book. Mm-hmm. But at the end, it seems that very one is the god.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So when on does she think it's only one god?
I think when she comes to the knowledge that she has been selfish and ugly, that she has tried to destroy Psyche, and that Psyche has in fact been married to a god, has been taken by the god, then
her perception then of the beauty and the glory and the wonder of that God make him the most important one. And he then, in a sense, embodies all of the other gods that she had previously believed in. And I think this is probably one of Lewis's little devices too, that he writes all through the book as though there are many gods, but then at the end, the direct confrontation that Orwell has is with one God, who is immense and wonderful and beautiful and glorious and terrible and unimaginable.
What do you make of all the there's the claims that Orwell makes that she realizes she was Unget. Do you really think that she was Unget, or she is like Unget?
I think it's not to be taken absolutely literally, because she has rejected the idea of Unget. Remember the earlier discussions when she, in her role as queen, has had to go to Unget's house. She rejects all of that darkness and the stench of blood and the ugly things that go on in Unget's house. But I think when she is brought into confrontation with the fact that not only is she physically ugly, but that she has an ugly soul. She has written earlier about Unget being a devouring thing, someone that just battens on the people and devours them, and the country is in famine and people don't have enough to eat, but Unget still has to have her share. And she hates that and rejects that aspect of Unget. And then when she realizes what she herself has done, she has battened and fed on Bardia all those years. It has drained him. She has not behaved worthily to Redivivus. And she realizes that she has done exactly the same things to the people in her life as she has accused Unget of doing. And that vision where her father drags her into the pillar room and they dig down and down and down, and he finally takes her to the mirror. And then she doesn't see her familiar ugly face or the veil. She sees that monstrous black blob of rock that was supposed to be the god of his house. And realizes that she had set herself up as being better, as wiser and more just than Unget. But she isn't.
She's in a sense just as to other people who don't infer her own life, kind of thing. She has no personal relationship.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. She has ignored things. She says towards the end, in her second book, I think, that she wished she had taken her nephew, who was to be her heir, and had lived with him and grown to know him and to love him. But she hadn't done that, because when Psyche was taken away from her, she resolved that she would never again love anything. And so, in her own, being wrapped up in herself and her own misery, she has, in effect, just completely overlooked her nephew. She could have done great things for him and helped prepare him to become the king. She didn't. She just sort of acted as though everything was out there. Nothing really touched her life directly except her own sense of injustice and misery.
And she went to great lengths to keep real busy when she kept making all those reforms.
Oh, yes.
And it sounded like she worked 24 hours a day there for a while to shut out everything else.
And that's part of her realization, too. Remember when Ansett, Bardia's widow, says to her, you just absolutely drained him dry. And she says, well, I didn't work him any harder than I worked myself. Still trying to justify herself. And,
refusal to acknowledge that anyone else had a right to a life of their own. She just wanted to drive herself, and then consequently also drove all of those around her.
One thing also that, right at the very, very end, where Arnhem writes the little tale to the story, he writes that this book was written by the Queen Oriole, by Queen Oriole of Glome, who was the most wise, just, valiant, fortunate, and merciful of all the princes known in our parts of the world. You know, I just was struck by the fact that apparently that everybody else doesn't realize what she's gone through.
No.
You know, and that they still see her as, I mean, she finds so many faults in herself, yet the rest, it seems like the rest of her kingdom thought that what she was doing was good, which wasn't very hopeful for the rest of, you know, nobody could learn from her.
No.
Nobody did learn from her experience.
There's that one section too, where is it? When she sets out on the journey, sort of her progress through the kingdom. And she takes only the young people with her. And she says that at first they were hesitant, they were in awe of her because of her veil. But then after a few days of traveling along the roads through the countryside and of camping at night, that they became, they all relaxed and had a good time and included her in their jokes. And just read to you again the two sections that have given me a measure of strength and comfort when I've been confronted with ugliness. I saw well why the gods do not speak to us openly nor let us answer. Till that word can be dug out of us, why should they hear the babble we think we mean? How can they meet us face to face till we have faces? And then I ended my first book with the words, "No answer. I know now, Lord, why you utter no answer. You are yourself the answer. Before your face, questions die away." Very, very hard to really hang on to, because the glimpses are rare and far, far between. And while you are standing in the face of God, it is easy to say, "You're the answer, and before your face all questions die away," and then God's face disappears again and the questions come back. Indeed, just Lord, if I do contend with thee, but sir, so what I plead is just. Now, let's see, The sots and thralls of lust do more in their spare hours prosper than I who spent sir life upon thy cause. Yeah, that's Hopkins. Sonnet 51, I think.